Good afternoon. My name is Omar Dagestani, and I have the honor and privilege to serve as the board chair of the City Club of Chicago. And I want to say on behalf of our entire board of governors and our team, welcome. Today we have an amazing panel, and Dean Deborah Gorman-Smith will introduce it in just a moment. But before that, I wanted to just share this all wouldn't be possible without our sponsors. So thank you to the City of Chicago, the Office of the Mayor, Cook County Health and Hospital Systems. Right over here, I saw the Greater Chicago Food Depository. All, please give these folks a round of applause, but don't worry. We have more. We have the Thier family, the Pritzker-Pucker Family Foundation, the Thier Family Foundation, generous people, again, making conversations like this possible, and it's really what drives all sorts of good public policy outcomes here in our city. Thank you to the University of Chicago. We appreciate your partnership and support. Thank you to Vivri Community. Please give them a round of applause. I'd like to thank Win-Win Communications. I got to say hi to a few of you earlier today. Hey, guys, thank you for being here. Dion Chicago Dream, thank you. And Stiefel, my own employer. So thank you to all of our sponsors. Before we talk about the program, I also wanted to acknowledge a few, really, there's so many of you in the room, but there are a few people that really I know have worked very hard to make this happen. First off, I want to say none of this would be possible without Danielle Parker. She's the COO of Dion Chicago Dream. And Danielle, you know, Kathleen said to say hi. She's been missing you. So I think the world of Danielle. She's a great visionary for the community and helps make things like this achievable. We've been friends for years. Adrian Talbot, Associate Dean of the Crown School. I don't think anyone is more committed to doing the right thing in terms of good public policy outcomes, serving the Crown School, but also serving the City of Chicago in good public policy. Adrian, thank you for being a friend. Jeff Pizzino. I want to say thank you to Jeff. He is with Dion Chicago Dream. He is one of the most amazing and humble grant writers, but he makes all these good things happen. So thank you. Give Jeff a round of applause. Finally, my friend, our friend, Commissioner Rachel Arfa, who takes care of so many good things for our city and is there for every good cause for people and serves as the Commissioner of People with Disabilities. And really, I just think of her as a superstar. So please give her a round of applause. Rachel's an amazing person. Kathleen and I both adore her, and we definitely need to have a drink sometime soon. With that, I wanted to indicate President Prankwinkle is currently attending to a health matter today. And so she sends her regrets, but also her strong appreciation for the City Club and all of our panelists that are going to come talk about SNAP and Medicaid and food insecurity today. These are important public policy problems and challenges and opportunities for the county, for the people of Cook County, for her personally, and she's very grateful for Dr. Eric Makitas, the CEO of Cook County Health, for coming to step in her place in this discussion. So in addition to that, I wanted to indicate that we have three other great panelists as well as our moderator. We have the CEO of Chicago Food Depository, CEO and president. I got to talk to Kate Mayer, what an amazing person. What an honor. Please give her a round of applause. I also had a chance to speak with Professor Carolyn Barnes from the Crown University of Chicago Crown School. Now, you know, City Club, we are nonpartisan, but I'm really proud and honored to introduce our moderator, Dion Dawson, who is not only the chief dreamer and founder of Dion Chicago Dream, But he was actually awarded one of the first honors from the City Club of Chicago for our amplification dinner. So please give them a round of applause. And to introduce the panel and what we're going to be talking about, I'd love to ask to the stage Dean Deborah Gorman-Smith, who's a great friend to Good Public Policy, leads the Crown Family School, and does amazing things in the community. So I'll turn it over to her, and we'll come back for questions right around 1 o'clock. So please come up with questions. I always love live questions, so you know we can go out and do the Phil Donahue. And we have a few pre-submitted, but I would love to have your questions and interactions. So thank you very much. And there are stairs on the other side, Deborah. Otherwise, you're welcome here. All right. Dean Deborah Gorman-Smith.
Good afternoon, everyone. As you've heard, it is my great honor and privilege to be Dean of the University of Chicago Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice. And I am also the Chief Strategist for Community Engagement and Partnership at the University of Chicago. And I'm really thrilled to welcome you all here today to this event that is co-hosted by the City Club and obviously the University of Chicago Crown Family School. We are always here to be in this room with so many committed civic leaders, scholars, and community advocates, all united by a shared purpose to build a stronger and more equitable Chicago. So I want to thank Omar and the entire City Club team for their partnership on this series over the last several years. The City Club has long been a place where Chicago's civic community comes together to engage with the most pressing issues of the day, and there is no more pressing issue right now than what is happening to the federal safety net and what it means for the hundreds of thousands of Cook County residents who depend on it. Our focus today is on SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and the sweeping federal policy changes now underway that are reshaping who qualifies, how benefits are administered, and what local systems are left to absorb. These are not abstract policy questions. They are questions about whether families in Cook County have enough to eat and whether the institutions we have built to support them can hold. So as you've heard, we have three remarkable leaders here to help us think through what this moment demands. Dr. Eric Makaitis is the CEO of Cook County Health, one of the largest public health systems in the nation, overseeing county care, the county's Medicaid managed care plan, and a network of hospitals and community health centers serving more than 600,000 residents each year. Kate Mayer is the executive director and CEO of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, which anchors a network of 800 community partner organizations across Cook County and has been at the forefront of the regional response to federal food policy changes. And I'm especially pleased to welcome Professor Carolyn Barnes, who is an associate professor at the Crown Family School, whose current research draws on interviews with hundreds of SNAP, WIC, and Medicaid beneficiaries and frontline workers to examine how families actually experience the administrative demands of these programs. Together, this panel brings together the health system, the community infrastructure, and the research evidence we need to understand not just what is happening, but what an effective response might look like. So thank you for being part of this important conversation. It's also so fun to look out and see so many Crown Family School alum. And with that, I will hand things over to Deion Dawson, who you've heard is the founder of Deion's Chicago Dream and one of Chicago's most thoughtful voices on food equity, who will moderate today's discussion. Thank you.
Those words. Let me see. Am I on? Can you hear me? Don't get all quiet now. You all were noisy when you were eating. Come on now, we got to stay woke today, okay? Okay. I don't want the quietest city club panel to be my panel, okay? So I'd rather it gets a little too loud in here than it get too quiet. You know, first and foremost, you know, I'm really, really excited to be here. Amazing panel. You know, first I want to thank City Club of Chicago, of course. Dean, Deborah Gorman-Smith, and all of you for being here for what I think will be one of the most important civic conversations we can have right now. Because today, well, while today's conversation is about SNAP and Medicaid policies, really also about something much larger, right? Who gets access? Who gets stability? And what happens when systems become harder to navigate for the people they were designed to support? Someone who works inside food systems every single day, I can tell you policy decisions do not stay in Washington. They show up in hospitals. They show up in schools. They show up in community organizations. They show up at kitchen tables. And eventually, they show up in people's bodies and lives. It's really, really hard talking to you all when I know so many people in the crowd, and I just want to say, hey, girl. We have an incredible panel to help us unpack that today. I'll ask each panelist one opening question individually, then we'll move into a broader discussion together before audience Q&A. My only rule for today, well, two rules. First and foremost, I'm going to tell everybody that I had the best panel at City Club in 10 years. So if anybody wants to repeat that, you know, just so it could be anchored somewhere. But more importantly, what I want you all to do is this is a conversation that has to be active and not passive. We're not saying we have all of the answers, but we're saying we're looking for answers. And so in addition to this information that is being presented, the opinions that are being shared and the dialogue that we try to engage in, I want you all to understand that you're also a part of it. That's the beautiful thing about Chicago being the greatest city in the world, is that we all have a collective responsibility for it. Okay? Sounds good?
Yeah, good.
All right. All right. Well, Dr. Mercatus, I'll start with you. I want to start with you because I think it's important that everyone in the room has a shared understanding of what's actually being proposed here, right? So can you give us in plain language, first and foremost, just a description of what's in H.R. 1 as it relates to SNAP and Medicaid?
Of course, yeah. Well, let me just start with a quick word of thanks, Deanne, to you and to my fellow panelists for welcoming me to the conversation, relatively short notice. I also want to thank the City Club, always a great event that they put on. And thank you to Adrian and the Crown School for pulling us all together. Very excited to tease this summer. We'll be making another partnership announcement with the Crown School around the impacts of the environment and health as it pertains to underserved communities. So really looking forward to the ongoing partnership there. Thank you. So HR 1, unfortunately, is the right. HR 1 really has SNAP and Medicaid in its crosshairs, unfortunately. The SNAP timeline is already in play. They're a bit ahead of the Medicaid timeline. SNAP in February implemented work requirements. They had about that month to figure out the system and ensure that people who are receiving benefits are working or volunteering 80 hours per month to remain eligible. And then in April, they changed the eligibility for certain immigrant populations. Shifting to Medicaid, kind of similarly, there's really four impacts to coverage. One has already come in into play. That was at the beginning of this year. There were ACA tax subsidies that have now been removed. So I've seen numbers anywhere from 30 to 90% increase in out-of-pocket costs for people covered under ACA, Obamacare, Affordable Care Act. And, you know, I'll just say from the health system have already seen a shift this first quarter, about 5% swing in our uninsured, which seemingly is people basically saying it's too expensive. I'm not going to maintain my coverage. Coming in October, similar to the April change in SNAP, there is going to be a change in who qualifies within the immigrant populations. Unfortunately, people who have verified asylum status and victims of domestic violence and human trafficking will no longer be covered under Medicaid. And not just not covered under Medicaid, they will no longer be eligible for any kind of insurance. They become uninsurable, right? So even if they chose to pay for coverage on the exchange, they won't be eligible. So, and in Illinois, that's about 10,000 individuals who are just going to become uninsurable in October. And then we have a 1-2 punch coming in January of 2027. That'll be work requirements, much like SNAP. And again, for Medicaid, it'll be 80 hours a month of working, volunteering, or being in school. The details around that are still unclear. The federal government has not provided those details yet to the states. They've indicated they'll have that by June. And the states have to implement and be ready to test by September. So they have 3 months to stand up the program and then 3 months of testing before go live in January. And then the other piece is redetermination. So that is the process whereby people validate that they remain eligible for Medicaid benefits. Right now, it's an annual process. As of January 27, they're going to double that cadence. So it'll be every 6 months. And it's a 2 to 3 month process for people to, you know, send the paperwork back and forth. So they're going to spend half the year filling out paperwork now that it's twice a year. A lot of impacts coming. I'll shift to kind of how we're bracing for impact at Cook County Health. We've done a lot of belt tightening in the last year. Redetermination started about 18 months ago, so we've already kind of seen that slow decline in Medicaid coverage. We had a $200 million gap to close last year, and I'm extremely proud of my leadership team. They were able to close that gap, but you can only belt tighten for so long as cuts continue to come. Looking forward, we've brought together the Medicaid Impact Work Group just extremely excited there around what's been happening. Over 60 organizations have partnered in a broader conversation, and beyond just healthcare, we've had hospitals, of course, FQHCs, we've had payers and public health departments join in the conversation. But beyond that, we've had academic leaders, business leaders, we've had philanthropic organizations and community organizations come to the table to have a more meaningful, broader discussion around how we mitigate these impacts that I was just talking about. Some really great outputs there. We've had three subgroups come out of the first couple of meetings, one focused on communicating and educating, and we have some resources here to help share some of those details, and then collaboration building and innovation. A lot of partnership with the state as well. So really the thinking there is with the broader group, right, we'll be able to accomplish more. We'll have better, more innovative discussions. And the hope there is that we'll mitigate the broader impact around Chicagoland.
Absolutely. And, when you and I met, it was actually, as you were named and you were interim CEO, and I think you've a lot of leaders who've kind of taken the mantle in the last 5 or 6 years have had the distinct pleasure of kind of having ground that continuously shifts under them. Mm-hmm. So I think just more on a personal note for you as a leader kind of looking out, what levers do you continuously have to like reimagine as you look at that ground always shifting?
Yeah, so I think that's where, we've taken the position that we're not powerless in this. We're not going to sit back and wait to have all of this done to us and to our communities that we serve. That was the whole point of the Impact Work Group, right, is to bring that broader group together and figure out how we can do more as a broader group, right? Like Helen Keller, right? You can together we can do so much, right? Mm-hmm. So that's really kind of the thinking there.
Absolutely, absolutely. Transitioning to Kate, I know you love the long-winded in people who introduce you and say how amazing your work is. But no, shifting to you, I think, Doc did a good job of helping us understand what it looks like from the health system side. But for your organization, being at the center of it through the lens of 800 community partners across the county, I would love for you to kind of talk about what that looks like on the community side, just initially, before I kind of dive in a little bit more.
Sure. I'm gonna take a step back first. So first of all, I just want to say I have I'm a proud City Club member, and I haven't been in a City Club luncheon since pre-COVID, and I am having all sorts of joy and also a little bit of just flashbacks, and it's great to be here. I'm also really deeply appreciative of the opportunity to have this conversation in this moment. Dion, you as a moderator and who helps every day sort of bring people together to think about innovation and ways that we rise up and respond. But I also, I'm just really grateful to the University of Chicago and the Crown School, Dean I'm just so glad that Carolyn is up here with us, and also longtime partners at Cook County Health and Hospital Systems. You all have lots of conversations you could be a part of that you choose to have this conversation in this moment matters so much because of all of the things that are at stake. And one of the things that I just feel this incredible urgency around is we need to provide more visibility to everybody into exactly what is happening. So the last time I was sitting in a City Club luncheon, I am sure that in my most emphatic way, I would have told you that we were dealing with a hunger crisis, because even before a pandemic and all of the upheaval that's happened economically over the last 6 years, we were serving an astonishing number of people through the emergency food system. Pre-pandemic, 800,000 people annually were showing up at these amazing community-based, often volunteer-led food pantries, soup kitchens, shelters in every corner of Cook County. When the pandemic happened, people fell into this deep, deep need, and it happened quickly. Within weeks of the emergency order going into place, we saw a doubling in the number of people turning to the emergency food system. And over the last 6 years, as there have been ups and downs, that has gone up and down. Soon after the emergency happened, or the emergency orders went into effect, Congress took action. They expanded SNAP benefits. They extended a child tax credit. There were some things that really stabilized people. They worked. Pantry lines got shorter. But then Congress undid those things at the same moment that inflation was beginning to have an impact, and in particular, food inflation. So 3 years ago, we began to see another dramatic surge of people turning to the emergency food system. And that's really the trajectory we have been on. And so July 3rd, before H.R. 1 was signed, the emergency food system in Cook County, and this is true across the state, and frankly, it is true across the country, we were serving more people than we had ever served in the history of all of these organizations. And then H.R. 1. Now, I think one of the things that the emergency food system has not done as well, over the years, we haven't told you as clearly as we could have the importance of SNAP. There's a lot of love today for the Greater Chicago Food Depository, and I appreciate that. There are also some other partners who are on the front lines I see in the room today. We appreciate the love and the attention, but I need to be super clear. For every meal that is made available through the emergency food system in this country, SNAP provides 9. And we have just seen a series of actions by Congress and the White House that will dismantle this program forever. And there is no plan B. I just want to be clear. If we think that the church basement food pantries across this city and across the country are all of a sudden going to get 9 times the amount of food, 9 times the amount of volunteers, we are sorely mistaken. And so that is the state on the ground today.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, you know, me and you, we've bonded over the sheer ridiculousness of of the things we have to do as food leaders to not only do what we do, but also to look ahead at, you know, a lot of this devastation, a lot of the dismantling, and we see the cost. We see the cost, you know, that the emergency food system is having to shoulder. I'd love for you to kind of talk about a lot, you as the representative of those partners, of what you're seeing with all of them, because I think everyone can see you and the Greater Chicago Food Depository, but not you as the representative of all of those partners and the load that they're carrying. Because when we think about the emergency food system, not only has SNAP not been prioritized and the importance of it has not been lifted, but also because of emergency food always having been there, we treat it as something that can't go away. And now we have to balance this out with seeing pantries and partners close doors, even as they try to figure out, again, selfishly, how to just serve everybody but themselves. So I'd love for you to kind of talk about that.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And so just full disclosure, Dion and I have spent a lot of time talking about a shared vision that we have, a dream that this is going to sound crazy coming from the food bank lady. I actually really look forward to a day that we don't need an emergency food system. And so maybe just to start with that, there is something that is so fundamentally broken. If we need 800 volunteer-run, community-based organizations in every neighborhood across the city to make sure that people have enough food, a basic need, to survive. So it's actually one area that I probably will find that I agree with some of the leaders in Washington, D.C. who put this into motion. Something wasn't working. But to pull away the tool that has been the first line of defense at a time that it is not working and there are unprecedented numbers of people is just cruel and, frankly, unconscionable. I would also say, as Dion pointed to, we see partners who are, I mean, they have been doing this work for 60-plus years. They want to retire. They can't do some of the physical work that we are talking about with receiving food and putting food on shelves, et cetera. I would also say we aspire to something better for our neighbors. Even the most amazing, dignified emergency food site is still not a place that most people want to have to go to. What people want is to be able to shop in a grocery store in their community and get great food that they choose. And so I think we have to challenge ourselves, how do we make that happen? That was part of the power of SNAP. So maybe just one word. Not only is what is happening to SNAP going to have this extraordinarily painful impact on individuals who face hunger, to be clear, it's also going to have a painful impact on grocery stores, on food companies, on farmers. Those SNAP dollars got spent in stores. Those stores hired people from the community to work in those stores. They put food on the shelves that were grown by people in this country. All of that has been wiped out. And I am not sure what the answer is for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, Kate. Transitioning.
Don't ask me. No.
Dr. McIdis and Kate described what it looks like from the health system and community organization perspective. Professor Barnes, your research puts you directly inside these systems, talking with families and frontline workers, navigating them every day. What are they telling you that maybe is invisible from the outside?
Oh, dear. Well, first, thank you for having me. I know we've done a lot of thanks, but this is such a wonderful opportunity. Thank you, Adrian, for organizing this. Thank you, City Club, for having me. Thank you to the University of Chicago and Deb for having me. I'm going to take a couple of steps back and talk about what it looks like to have challenging experiences with applying to benefit programs. So I don't know if I'm the biggest nerd in the room, but I guess I might be the biggest nerd on the panel.
And I don't know.
Well, that's true.
I think we can nerd out together.
All right. But this has been the challenge. Like, how nerdy do you want to get? But there is this concept called administrative burden, which essentially just means any onerous experiences you might have with policy implementation. And everybody has experienced some form of administrative burden. I know I experienced administrative burden going to the Secretary of State and trying to get an Illinois license. You might have experienced administrative burden when you're trying to get your passport approved in an expedited fashion. So there are all these ways that we experience the state and that can be challenging. The problem is when these costs So the federal government and the research community has categorized all these different costs. So learning costs might be, you know, I don't know that a program exists and that I might be eligible to apply and how to apply. Compliance costs are essentially like, what do I have to do to meet the rules of the program? Do I have to submit a bunch of documents and fill out a complicated application? And psychological costs being the stress and the stigma of that whole process. I have to share all this personal information with an agency about my life. And then the challenge of actually using the benefit once I've been deemed eligible, redemption costs. Problem is, a lot of us in here can bear those costs because we're well-resourced. But in the United States and in some other countries, we've designed programs that target low-income or marginalized families, and they can't. And these costs disproportionately burden those who literally can't pay them. So I'm a little more optimistic about SNAP. I've been thinking about this since we've been starting this conversation. States are still required to implement this program. They are still required to. These new changes around work requirements, and I think we'll talk about cost sharing in a little bit, that's designed to, in theory, improve quality control. But what it's really going to do is make the program far more expensive for states to implement in ways that's going to discourage people from participating. And that's what I'm really, really concerned about. And we can get into the weeds on what that looks like in a couple minutes, but that's what I'm really concerned about. The goal for a lot of these SNAP changes, because administrative burden is also defined as policymaking by other means. So a goal for a lot of these SNAP changes is, in a hidden way, something that's less visible than a direct cut to SNAP, how can we figure out ways to retrench the state, to pull back provisions? How can we figure out ways to make the program more expensive and disincentivize participation? And that's what I'm really concerned about with these HR1 changes. And families are going to feel it. So a lot of my work was done during the COVID pandemic, when we did the opposite. We had an incredible period of expansion, and when the federal government and the Biden nerds got together and decided, let's figure out ways to reduce administrative burden. There were a ton of executive orders around improving customer service. So we go from that to now having all of these new costs erected and new challenges and barriers erected and making this program far more complicated for that eligibility worker to implement. So I'll leave it at that.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. So I think now's a good time to kind of bring you, I want to bring all three of you into this next question, because it really sits at the intersection of everything we've been discussing. It's a buzzword right now, which is work requirements. Work requirements are often framed publicly as a pretty straightforward idea. If someone can work, they should work. But research from prior experiments, including even in Arkansas, found that many of the people who lost coverage were already working or were exempt, multiple jobs, even to this day. But lost benefits because of paperwork issues, reporting failures, or administrative complexities. So from your respective vantage points, does that finding match what you're seeing, even though we know it can be complicated and multifaceted?
So if I can give a real-life example about administrative burden to Carolyn's point, in county care and how we administer currently, the redetermination process has started and has restarted about 18 months ago, as I said earlier. But we see through that process that we lose about 12% of the people going through that process. Now, the state average is closer to 25 to 28%, so across all health plans, right? So, which, again, is one of the things we're talking about at the Impact Work Group. How do we define best practices, make sure that we lose as few people as possible? But when we look at that 12% that we lose, 3 out of 4 of those people are losing their coverage because of administrative issues. Updated addresses, paperwork not getting where it needs to go, not coming back, right? So to double that cadence, right, to lose 12% twice as often now and throw on top work requirements, which is another administrative process, we're only going to accelerate those losses, right? And if we want to talk about Arkansas for a second, just to put some background on that, they tried that in 2018, right? They lost 18,000 people in 4 months when they turned the program on. Federal judge had to stop the program. And when they looked back, 97% of those 18,000 people were exactly like you said. It was administrative processes. They should have been either exempt or eligible and maintain their coverage. And it cost the state $26 million to stand up and administer the program. That's $26 million they didn't spend on covering health care. Georgia, same thing. The year that they implemented the program, they spent $3 standing up and administering the program to every dollar they spent providing health care. So it's, again, to the point of, you know, creating policies that force the states to waste money to do things administratively and create barriers and hurdles. You know, and I'll share through the president's leadership and through NACO, we had the opportunity to meet with some of the policymakers at CMS and have a conversation. It was a broader team, not just Cook County, but you know, what became apparent as we were talking is that, you know, there's a part of this question of, you know, is it functioning as intended? And I have a hard time saying that it isn't. And I think this is the intent, is to get people off and push costs down to states and get it off the federal books and create these burdens so that people fall off the rolls.
Thank you for saying that. I mean, I think that's exactly right. So let me, I think there are a couple of myths that I just want to bust pretty clearly. So first of all, this idea around, and I cringe when I hear this term, work requirements. There have always been work requirements for SNAP. And so there is this narrative that all of a sudden some leaders in Washington, D.C. had this idea that people should work, which sounds very reasonable, but it masks all sorts of truth that don't necessarily get brought forward. So in Illinois, in 1996, when the welfare reform bill happened, there was a whole set of new requirements that came into place. But there was also a provision that said if states have unemployment rates in parts of the state that are above a certain level, it may not make sense for some of these work requirements to go into place. And so we will have a mechanism that states can apply for waivers. Illinois, because we have places, we have counties where our unemployment rate has been above the threshold, has always qualified. And in every governor since 1996, whether they were a Democrat or a Republican, every governor has supported having these waivers in place. What H.R. 1 did is it said no more waivers. Now imagine we are a state with 2 million people on SNAP, and we have just learned that the entire way that this program operates has to change immediately. At the same time, there is this narrative about efficiency and smaller government, and I want to be very clear. This is incredibly costly. The question is just that, who pays for it? Is it going to come out of the federal coffers or the state coffers? In order to comply with this new law, the state of Illinois is going to have to spend hundreds of millions of dollars. We are going to have to hire many more people. We are going to have to create new systems, new bureaucracy, and we are going to impose this on a group of people who really just want food, right? Mm-hmm. Right? And so it is heartbreaking to see how this mythology of we just need people to work is being weaponized against people who, to your point, are working. In our experience, the people who are facing hunger in this community, this isn't a not working issue. This is a wage issue. Right? So the reason people are showing up in food pantry lines is because they are working many jobs. And those many jobs are not enough. And therefore, they need to supplement at the end of the month their paychecks with the food that they get through food pantries. We are not addressing the core reason that people face hunger, but to your point, that is not the intention here. The intention is to make what has, I think, arguably been the most successful government program ever, we are making it go away. And that is what will happen. Even though you have some optimism about how states are thinking about it, we are hearing from states who are just saying, we're not going to be able to do this. Thankfully, in Illinois, our governor, our deputy governors, our director of human services, they are fighting to do everything they can to keep this program in place. But it will be uneven at best how this program comes forward in this country.
If it feels as though the compliance infrastructure has become so complicated that it effectively functions as exclusion infrastructure.
100%.
And so, but Dr. Barnes, I love
Dan,
you.
Dan, I think that's the feature, not the bug.
Here, here.
Absolutely.
That's accurate.
Yeah.
That's accurate.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm supposed to answer. So the reason why I'm a little more optimistic, and I'm not sure, it's a federally mandated program, so I'm not sure if states can opt out of it. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a question. You know, I wonder what kind of lawsuits are going to happen in the next couple of years as, you know, some of these changes time on and time off. But to your broader point, the broader point made earlier, this is a cost-saving exercise for the federal government. The goal is to reduce spending by $69 billion by 2034. That is the objective for these work requirements, the objective for all of these new HR 1 administrative changes for SNAP, and to shift those costs to states. So states have more, quote unquote, skin in the game in delivering the program. So, you know, I agree with everything that's been said. It's going to affect families who are already eligible. From where I sit, as somebody who's worked with SNAP units and interviewed SNAP workers, it fundamentally changes how the program functions. So, yes, there's always been work requirements, but typically what I've seen is that there's a special team that works with, you know, able-bodied adults without dependents that focus on those cases because it's a sliver of the many families that are receiving SNAP. So there's a big caseload of families with kids under 18 that are receiving SNAP for which those work requirements don't apply. There's a lot of people for which the work requirements don't apply. The challenge has been that the ages and the exemptions have changed dramatically under this new law to where now SNAP workers have to focus on that. And they never had to focus on implementing these work requirements before. That's a whole new different task and a whole new different role that a SNAP unit has to figure out how to do. And that learning curve is steep. It's really steep. Adjusting to policy change is super difficult to do on the ground and in such short time. So I do worry that we're going to see what we saw in Arkansas, where a lot of people who are eligible are pushed off the program because it's just too difficult for agencies to implement.
Absolutely. I want to zoom out for a little bit because what we're describing today is not just an immediate crisis, but there's also a long-term structural fiscal shift happening underneath all of this. So, you know, analysts estimate that changes to federal cost savings, cost sharing agreements could literally hit Illinois roughly around, like you said, $800 million annually by 2027. That's not abstract. You know what I mean? That becomes a question of who absorbs the cost, what gets reduced, and what systems begin to strain. So, you know, from your perspectives, again, you know, public health, community response, and research, you know, what does that timeline actually look like?
Well, so let me just call out, I'll pull a thread through.
Of course.
So we know from healthcare data that food insecure houses, the food insecure individuals have almost a 50% higher rate of high blood pressure, diabetes, mm-hmm. higher rates of anxiety and depression, ultimately leading to a 20 to 25% higher cost of care, right? Mm-hmm. So we are, while we're making it harder to get food benefits, we are at the same time taking away health insurance. So we're creating, we're predisposing people to be sicker and then taking away their health insurance behind that. So we know now that they won't on the back end engage to have their chronic disease managed, right? And that then is going to result when they're uninsured, they'll be coming to safety net health systems. And mm-hmm. for those who follow kind of what's been going on in the safety net ecosystem, we've already seen two hospitals close, and that's without any of this stuff coming into play. So there will be an incredible increase in pressure and stress on the safety net ecosystem. So to your question about timeline, I think the next 12 to 18 months, we're going to see a huge bolus of chaos and people trying to figure out how to navigate the system. So probably a lot of losses early on in terms of coverage and access to food. But then after that, it's going to be a slow burn. And I think a few years out, we're going to see kind of this ticking time bomb of people who, as I said, have lost their food benefits, have lost their health insurance, right? Now we're sicker, right? Sicker population. And I know we're talking about $800 million annually, but Commonwealth Fund is estimating just in Illinois, $2.5 billion coming out of the GDP and $200 million out of the tax base because people will be too sick to work.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay.
This is depressing me. I think part of what is really maddening about this bill is there was great intention. I think to the point that was made earlier, this is exactly having a dismantling and a disruption of this program was exactly what was intended. And there are also parts of this bill that are incredibly vague and not well thought out, or not thought out at all. And so part of what is so complicated in this moment is how much we don't know. There is a whole flurry of activity right now in the SNAP world because this decision about how much Illinois is going to have to pay annually in order to keep the program, and I'll talk just in a moment about how that works, it is going to be determined by a somewhat random measure, and we won't know the number of that measure until the end of June, and presumably the state's going to have to turn around and pay that amount. Well, our General Assembly is done at the end of May. The time period when we make budget decisions in Illinois will be behind us. So how we even do this, no one's quite sure. And let me just say, while it is true that SNAP is still a mandated program, what is also becoming clear is that the way this law was written, states have to pay the total amount of their cost share. So in Illinois, if the number ends up being $800 million annually, we have to pay all of that before the state or before the feds pay anything. So we can't just show up and say, you know what, we only had $600 million. That won't be acceptable. And so what this is going to do to states like, in fact, every state that is dealing with tight budgetary environments, nobody knows. And so it's the uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So that uncertainty certainly impacts state agencies. It impacts organizations on the ground feeding people. We're all looking at each other trying to figure out what's going to happen. And it also impacts our neighbors. Mm. And so part of the response that we are seeing, in fact, there was just a report that came out from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Before the rules have even begun to go into effect, there are dramatic declines in SNAP participation happening across this country. And one of the theories is that people are hearing this. There was the government shutdown, SNAP benefits were turned off. Neighbors are thinking, okay, this program, it's gone, it's going away, it's not for me, I'm just not going to bother. Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, before the rules even go into effect, the damage has been done.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Dr. Barnes.
The cost-sharing components of this bill, that's what keeps me up at night more than the work requirements, because it has shifted so many costs to states. So typically, and before HR1, typically the federal government would pay the cost of the full SNAP benefit, and states would share 50% of the administrative costs. And now states are on the hook for 75% of the administrative costs, and the federal government is going to pay 25%. But if states aren't meeting that number that you were talking about, the error rate, so the error rate being, if you've overpaid somebody or underpaid a SNAP beneficiary for their benefit for the month, if they don't meet the error rate, they're on the hook for paying for the actual cost of the benefit. So it's changed a lot. It's changed fundamentally how the program looks and is delivered. It's changed the expenses of programs of the program for states. It's made it incredibly expensive to deliver. And, you know, I don't know what states are going to do because, you know, I'm worried about the Southeast in particular because there's no tax base to flip the bill for the administrative costs. And we've already seen uneven outcomes administratively across the country. Right. So like my experience in North Carolina when I try to apply for SNAP is going to be very different than my experience in the state of Illinois because the state of Illinois has a better tax base. Mm-hmm. So we're going to see that unevenness as this rolls out in the coming year. So
definitely. Thank you, Three. We're going to transition now to Q&A, so I'll let you take it away, Omar.
I want to thank you, Dion, and thank our panelists. Please give them a round of applause. This is such a difficult but important topic, and one that I trust will continue in conversations. I know many of you have questions, and we like to have this be a conversation between all of us and the panelists. So I'd like to go to the audience and see who has a question. Fantastic. I'll be right there.
I think while Omar is walking back there, I'll let Dr. Makaitis plug something for Cook County. Go ahead.
Thank you, Dion. So two resources here today. I brought up the Medicaid Impact Work Group. To those of you in the room who are already participating, thank you. We've gotten where we've gotten because of the broader conversations that you all have helped us have. We have one resource, looks like this. It's got a QR code for those who may not be participating yet. We would welcome your voices at the table as well, if anything resonated with you that we were talking about. And then the other one is a microsite that this group, the Impact Work Group, has launched. We launched it about a month ago. There's two purposes to it. The first is to engage individuals on Medicaid. There's an FAQ. There's a link out to HFS that helps people update their information. And then there's events there where people can go to redetermination events, stay enrolled. There's a second piece to it, though, and that's for our community organizations, churches, businesses, schools, to download a toolkit that helps people have a standardized communication out to their communities. We took an open source approach. It is not branded to Cook County Health. We welcome and ask everyone to brand it to their own brands because we think there'll be an extra layer of trust. When you put your brand on it, if it's an individual doctor's office, they put their name on it and give it to their patients, extra layer of trust there. So please, it's free to download, brand it to your own organizations. Please help us amplify the website and communicate through the toolkit.
That is awesome. So that is awesome. I'm glad you said that. And my colleague sitting over there would be like throwing things and hitting me in the head if I didn't say. So there is a similar approach that's coming forward in SNAP, saveoursnap.org. And it has all of the toolkits, the QR codes, the everything. But here's the additional pitch. There may be people in this room right now who are on SNAP or are eligible for SNAP or Medicaid. Or if not, you may likely know somebody. So I need everybody to go out of this conversation because we still have people who haven't gone through this process, mm-hmm. and they will lose life-saving benefits if we can't connect them. It is hard. And so we have to take all of the extra steps, not just to assume that people are going to go to the website or assume that they are going to go through the process of redetermination. We may have to have a conversation with them. We may have to encourage them and remind them that it's okay to go through this process. So everything this audience can do, I think, is going to be critical.
Hey, thank you so much. And I really, by the way, I appreciate those calls to action because that's what City Club is about. And by the way, I love your... notion of, you know, branding it under other organizations and not, you know, just under Cook County Health, although we certainly appreciate your leadership in that. So thank you both. I think these are great calls to action, and this is what we come together for. We do have our first question, and then we'll certainly get around the audience. Yes, thank you. If you introduce yourself.
I'm Jenny Hall. I'm the CEO of Beyond Hunger, which serves West Cook County and the west side of Chicago. And I don't really have a question. I just want to thank, I'm so grateful to our state, and I'm grateful to the Greater Chicago Food Depository, because you've made as many people eligible as you possibly can, and I just really appreciate that. I can't say enough, people in the room don't know what the state has done to try to make people be able to qualify, to continue to be able to use SNAP is so impressive. And so we're a food pantry, we couldn't continue to do this work if we didn't have that support, and I just want to thank you all so much for that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this fantastic presentation. My name is Graham Grady, and I'm an attorney, but I serve on a board of a local foundation. I wanted to thank you for this. Yesterday, I attended a meeting of the Cook County Economic Development Advisory Committee, and we had a terrific presentation by Kyla Williams-Tate, who's the Digital Equity Director of Cook County. And she shared some shockingly alarming news to us with regard to the incredible, limited access to broadband for so many people in Cook County. So when I saw the notion, and if I don't say this correctly, I don't mean to insult, when I saw the notion of connection and downloading the QR code, so many people have to go to Starbucks or to their public library or have some teenager in their family, you know, help them complete the forms. So there's sort of a corollary problem that complicates this whole thing. You mentioned administrative burden, that a lot of people don't have basic access to broadband, and now they have to do this twice a year, et cetera. So on this other existing lovely note about HR1, I wondered if you could comment about potential solutions for people to be able to have basic access to broadband so they can attempt to comply to maintain their SNAP benefits.
Anybody want to take a stab?
That's a great question. I think we've been trying to go more through a low-tech innovation because we know it is a big challenge. And I know the president is actively involved in the broadband discussions as well. But that's why we're asking for the activation from our community partners as well so that we can get the word out and get those access points for our community members who do struggle with that.
I would just note there's an incredible ground game that's happening right now. So Jenny Hull just stood up. She has people in her organization who are helping people who come in to a food pantry. And this is happening in every neighborhood. My colleague Daniel Perry is over here. I feel like there was a period of time where she was going to four churches on a given Sunday. And so making sure that faith communities, libraries you referenced, every single asset in every single community is equipped and that we are doing outreach that allows us to bridge all of the divides, including the digital divide. Broadband access is a huge issue and need. But I also want to disabuse us of, like, I don't personally want to put my advocacy energy into allowing this HR1 and its rules to continue. I am not willing to give up the fight on this. And so.
Absolutely. Anything on that? Okay.
Absolutely. Thank you. And that's a great question and appreciate your responses. We have time for probably two more questions.
So. All right, we had that one. Do we have one up here up front? Okay. Gotcha.
We'll make it three more, but I'm trying to go in order.
Thank you. I'm Terry Gens from Lutheran Social Services of Illinois. This really angers me. I'm sure it angers everyone in this room. So this is a federal policy. So how do we change this with taking over the House or the Senate with the upcoming midterms? I mean, what's the goal of switching people who will turn over this cruel thing?
Thank you.
I just recognize I have colleagues over here, many of whom have just gotten off the bus from Springfield. So this is, yes, there's a federal opportunity, but frankly, we have to be working at all levels, and we all have to be way more engaged. Mm-hmm. This is, the people who put this into motion have been playing a very long game. Mm-hmm. And we will not undo it with one election, but we have to mount our own long game. So that's one thing. I will also say we've got to lean in. So I know, like, you can get nerdy. I say that with affection, but there's a farm bill that's happening right now. Absolutely. And I'm sure everyone sort of glosses over when you see that little tidbit in the Tribune about a farm bill. What does that have to do with us? Well, that is the mechanism that funds SNAP. Yep. Mm-hmm. And there is all sorts of backroom dealing happening right now. And so we have to make sure, and we have in Chicago members of the Farm Bill or of the House Agriculture Committee who serve. And so we need to be talking to them. This matters. SNAP matters. I care about SNAP. This can't just be a food bank issue. And so I think for all of us to be able to lift our voices into this cacophony so that no elected official, whether they are a federal, state, or county official, thinks it's okay. That's what we're talking about. For it to be okay for people to not have food in the greatest country in the world is insane. Mm-hmm. And we have to say that.
Thank you. I think we had one other question right here.
Hold on.
If I could add quickly, just Through President Preckwinkle's leadership, I mentioned NACO and to your point, Kate, around National Association of Counties, to Kate's point about advocating at all levels. Under her leadership, we're having the same conversations with county leadership across the country. And what's interesting about the information and the projections, red states and counties will be harder hit than blue states and counties.
That's exactly right.
So, and there is a general lack of awareness of that fact when you talk to red state and county leadership, right? Actually. So it's getting them to get aware and aligning those incentives to make sure that we're all singing from the same song sheet.
I will say, I think this might be a wake-up call and a potential political turning point, not just for administrators and advocates, but for everyday people. So there's been this big theory about a government-citizen disconnect. People don't know how much their lives are supported by the government. And I think this administration has demonstrated that people's lives are drastically impacted by these programs. And I think it's going to be a wake-up call.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the thoughtful response. Did we have one more up here?
Yes.
I think so.
Yes.
Hi. I'm Carol Adams, former Secretary of Human Services for the state of Illinois.
Hey,
by
Carol.
The way, Illinois named SNAP. They were so impressed that we had Link. They asked us for suggestions about names back in the day. So I'm taking us back in the day because we really need to turn 60s about this thing. Okay? Instead of trying to work on how to adapt, because this is not about reform, this is about dismantling. This is about taking us back to another century when it comes to what we're doing. So we got to think revolution here, okay? Now, how you going to adapt to it? How you going to organize, protest, hit the street, snap back? That's got to be our motto. We have to snap back. Because
you
can't make this work.
Amen.
It's unworkable.
Amen.
Well, can I just respond really quick?
Yes.
I'll try not to talk too much because I don't want to be fired as the moderator. But I think it's a good time as we kind of transition to close. I think, you know, first and foremost, I'm really thankful for this conversation. I would just challenge everybody here to have more difficult conversations. I think this is one of the few times where I'm leaving a city club meeting or another civic or social gathering and I'm not okay. You're not meant to be okay right now. And so, you know, when we talk about snapping back, when we talk about organizing, this thing called democracy is fragile. And everybody plays a part in it. And so when we think about this, we've been insulated because we've been in Illinois. And we've been insulated because we've been in Chicago or in the suburbs of Chicago or downstate. And I think right now what we're seeing is that no longer can we hide behind being a blue state. Because what we've seen is all of those protections, that social safety net, the food safety net, all of it is gone. And so now what do you do? And so, of course, we have to acknowledge and empower ourselves. But I am okay with walking out of this room not smiling. We're not meant to just go back and handle business as usual. We have to ask ourselves, how are we looking at that technology divide and access in communities? And are we paying for someone's technology? Are we, you know, reaching out to the business leaders? And quite frankly, I love that question because we're building a 20,000 square foot facility in Inglewood right now. And we wanted to bring free Wi-Fi and internet access. And I had to send an email yesterday to the VP of Comcast, which is not in Chicago, because they said right now that technology does not exist. And I will not take no as an answer. And so I think when we hear about everything that all of these three talked about, I want everyone in here to understand you cannot take no as an answer anymore. There is no no in your vocabulary. We have to figure out what we need to do, and we all have to do our part. So I just want to thank you all, of course, Crown School, City Club, everybody, Dean, of course. I'm going to work with you more. I'm standing in public so that, you know, your team does not block me. But no, thank you all so much. Adrian, of course, I love you, and everybody here, I appreciate it.
Hey. On behalf, I want to thank the panelists. Give them another round of applause. I also want to remind you guys, we have a few handouts, again, that you can participate and use the QR codes as referenced earlier. So I really want to encourage everybody to take those as takeaways. Get involved with these organizations up here. You know, take a stand and, you know, I think Deanne said it right. You know, don't take no for an answer. I appreciate y'all. City Club is adjourned.
Absolutely.